Hi, my name is Brad Katz. I'm a professor of ophthalmology and neurology at the University of Utah and the Moran Eye Center.
And hello, my name is Eric Cassie. I'm a visiting instructor or fellow in ophthalmology and visual sciences at the University of Utah, the Moran Eye Center.
And we're here to talk about diagnosing photophobia in children, specific causes. I thought we'd start off by talking about kids that are less than 5 years old, because that's really challenging, you know, to examine a little kid like that. And also in my experience, like, that's just not a very common symptom in a little kid. What are some of the main causes of photophobia in kids under the age of five?
Yeah, you're exactly right. They're not exactly going to be able to tell you that they're having photophobia. So it's going to take some investigation. But some things that you can think of off the bat are, first and foremost, would be congenital glaucoma. It's not a very common disorder, but it's one that's pretty well described. And the classic signs are tearing, epiphora, along with a cloudy cornea and view follows. That can be associated with blepharospasm, as well as, you know, of course, the loss of vision with congenital glaucoma. So definitely something that you don't want to miss. Other things that are vision threatening include retinal dystrophies, such as achromatopsia. One of the presenting symptoms can be sensitivity to light. Some other things to consider are strabismus, or squint, as well as juvenile arthritis, uveitis, and aniridia.
Yeah, those are all, you know, super important causes of light sensitivity in a small kid that you wouldn't want to miss. But then there are also some neurologic things that could present as light sensitivity. You know, kids with cortical visual impairment might have light sensitivity. And then you don't want to miss a case of meningitis or a posterior fossa tumor.
Sure.
But luckily, those two things usually have other symptoms that go along with them. So in terms of diagnosing these kids, I guess you almost have to do an examination under anesthesia, wouldn't you think?
It would certainly make things a lot easier. It's very difficult to examine these young kids. And an exam under anesthesia would definitely provide the most information. So you can get a good look at the cornea. You can measure the eye pressure. You can examine the retina. You can look for inflammatory conditions. So all of those would be best done under an exam under anesthesia.
You know, and if you're really fortunate, you might have an electrophysiologist on your staff, and they can even come in, you know, with you while the kid's asleep and do some electrophysiology if you're suspecting a retinal or an optic nerve problem.
Yeah, that's how you can really get some definitive information. And you can get some objective info with brain imaging as well. Of course, that will require anesthesia in almost all cases.
Yeah, it's a little bit tricky to schedule these things, you know, especially if you're not associated with a hospital that specializes in the care of children, you know, coordinating. You know, you want to put the kid to sleep as few times as necessary, and, you know, try to coordinate all these things can sometimes be difficult if you're outside of a tertiary children's hospital. So I think that covers, you know, kids less than five pretty well, which fortunately is pretty uncommon. Let's talk a little bit about the ophthalmic causes of kids that are over the age of five.
So over the age of five, you get more into the things that come more to mind in adults, and that could include things like ocular surface disease, conjunctivitis, and uveitis, any sort of intraocular inflammation.
Right. And, you know, hopefully, you know, with older kids, you know, they can, you can at least get them into the slit lamp and you can tell if they have one of those problems, you know, unlike the younger kids that we were talking about earlier, you know. And then, you know, I agree with you, Eric, you know, just the most common causes of light sensitivity in kids over the age of five is going to look pretty similar, you know, with some exceptions, to the causes in adults. And in my experience, the three big ones are going to be migraine, and then, you know, a distant second are traumatic brain injury, and a distant third is going to be blepharospasm. Do you see blepharospasm much in kids?
Not very often, no. There's some literature out there on blepharospasm in children, but it's a pretty rare condition overall. There's three primary causes, from my understanding, and the first being tic disorders, the next being reflex blinking, and the last one being benign benign blepharospasm. Do you see much blepharospasm in children, Dr. Katz?
No, thank goodness. It's pretty uncommon, you know, certainly when compared to adults. But we did do a study at Utah in conjunction with Wilmer Eye Hospital. And, you know, we did come up with, you know, like a small cohort of kids and adolescents with what appears to be benign essential blepharospasm. The thing that's tricky in kids is that blepharospasm can look just like a tick. And of course, tick disorders can be, are much, much more common in kids than benign essential blepharospasm. So I just, you know, maybe we should talk briefly about some of the things that might help a practitioner differentiate benign essential blepharospasm from ticks.
Tick disorders, to my understanding, and you think most often of blinking eyes, but it's not just that necessarily. It can also include flaring nostrils, raising their eyebrows, opening the mouth, clicking the tongue, clearing the throat, all sorts of oropharyngeal movements, even including grunting. And you can even split that up into chronic motor tics that last, or have been present for greater than a year, or a full-blown Tourette disorder, which frequently will include vocalizations.
Yeah, luckily the kids with tics, in my experience anyway, and Tourette's, the photophobia is not a primary complaint with them. So it's just, if you have a kid with photophobia and they're blinking their eyes, you do, you know, you want to make sure it's not reflex blepharospasm, but then you also want to, you don't want to throw benign essential blepharospasm out the window because it's a kid. It's part of the differential. But luckily, some of these other disorders are, they're not going to present with a presenting complaint of light sensitivity. You know, and then I thought we would just talk for a minute about some of the other visual symptoms that, you know, because we're talking about kids here, they may not be able to, you know, articulate exactly what's going on. And so when they say they're sensitive to light, you want to make sure they don't have some of the other, you know, visual symptoms that might be related. I was kind of, you know, the thing that came up to the top of my head was like a visual aura. You know, a kid might talk about being light sensitive, and then you have to ask some probing questions to see if what they're really experiencing is an aura and not just light sensitivity. Maybe you should talk for a minute about visual snow. What's your experience with visual snow in kids?
So visual snow can be a hard one to pin down. It usually does start in childhood, but it's not only difficult to describe, but kids may not even really report it because they don't know either the words to describe it, or that's how their vision has been for a long time, and that may think of that as normal. So that can be a tough one to pin down. You again have to ask more probing questions to see, to kind of flesh out the history that you can gather, because the exam is going to be unrevealing.
When I was first, you know, introduced to visual snow, it was described as TV static. And of course, nobody has TV static anymore. So that's, you know, we have to find a new way. You know, what I've resorted to in clinic is opening up Google Images. And there are lots of cool images in Google of people's like artistic representation of what their snow looks like. And you can certainly show those pictures to patients and say, well, does it look like this? And sometimes that's helpful when they can't find the words.
Yes, using the Google machine for sure.
Yeah. And then, you know, this is again, like uncommon, but another thing that kids might notice would be entopic phenomena. Mm-hmm. You know, in our clinic, we have a blue field generator, which is really cool for like anybody can look in that thing and see their own entopic phenomenon. But, you know, that's another thing that I think that a kid might be seeing and could possibly misrepresent as light sensitivity.
Yeah, perfect. So just to summarize things for our discussion here today, we talked about how we diagnose photophobia in kids as the chief complaint. There's many different causes to consider, but the top one is probably migraine, just because it's so much more common than all the others. You also have to ask about a history of traumatic brain injury, and because that can predispose them to post-traumatic light sensitivity as well. And photophobia in kids less than 5, although very uncommon, can be a serious ophthalmic or neurologic condition. So something to be taken seriously.
Right. And then in a separate podcast, we'll talk a little bit more about exam techniques and a little bit more about how to elicit a history of migraine where there seems to be none.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to that. Thank you, Dr. Katz.
And then I just want to remind everybody that this podcast is part of a comprehensive curriculum for the diagnosis and treatment of photophobia in children. You can contact me if you have questions about this at my email, bradley.katz, K-A-T-Z at hsc.utah.edu. And
this curriculum is protected by a copyright held by the University of Utah and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the university.
Yeah, we're happy to distribute this and have people use it for teaching purposes, but please don't rebroadcast it without asking for permission. Thank you.